Every Christian, sometime or other, questions his faith. People who tell me that isn't so are either being, to my mind, rather dishonest, or else they must be extremely thick. Because anybody with a modicum of grey matter between their ears can see that there's an awful lot in this world that seems, on the face of it, to contradict a breezy confidence in God. And there's Ethiopian famine and Mexican earthquake. There's terminal cancer and congenital handicap. There are disasters and wars and miseries and sufferings of a thousand kinds in this world. And each one asks the same silent question of any honest Christian. How can a good God allow it? The only sort of faith that's immune from that kind of questioning is a blind faith. A faith that dare not look the realities of the world in the face. A faith that has to close its mind off to anything that threatens its creed. But that's an irrational faith. A cowardly faith. To my mind, it's a faith that fully deserves the contempt of the unbeliever. Because unbelievers tell us, you know, that we are just pathetic weaklings who need a crutch of faith to limp through life with. And when we run away from questions like that, we're just proving what they say is true. Now, real faith isn't blind. Real faith doesn't shut its eyes to evidence that seems to contradict its convictions. It can't do that. Real faith has to confront the reality and the suffering and the evil of this world. It has to accept the experience of doubt that accompanies that confrontation. Because to fail to do that would be the denial of true faith, wouldn't it? Not its affirmation. Perhaps that's what the poet Tennyson meant when he said he thought there was more faith in honest doubt than in half the creeds. It's important to understand this, though, right at the outset. Contrary to popular myth, doubt isn't the opposite of faith. To suggest it is to confuse doubt with unbelief. No, they're two quite different things. If you think about it, doubt is something only a believer can experience. You can only doubt what you believe. When an atheist doubts, he doubts that God might be there after all. That's his doubt. What is the book of Job in the Bible, if it isn't the story of a believer wrestling with doubt? Job didn't cease to be a believer whilst he was wrestling with doubt in that way. On the contrary, properly understood, the very struggles that he had with doubt testified to the tenacity of his faith. And at the end of the day, they contributed towards the development of his faith and the strengthening of it. And in fact, this is a general truth of practical Christian experience. Doubt only becomes a problem when you're afraid of it and try and run away from it. Christians who have the courage to engage with doubt, honestly and frankly, they find that far from being weakened by the conflict, their experience of God, in fact, grows stronger, more intimate, as a result of those inner struggles. Now, there's no better example of that in all the Bible, I think, than Psalm 73. This is the book of Job in a nutshell, if you like. Here's a poem written by a man who knew exactly what doubt felt like. He tells us in verse 2, he came within a hair's breadth of abandoning his faith in God altogether. As for me, he says, my feet had almost slipped. I'd nearly lost my foothold. And yet you see the testimony of the man at the end of the psalm is that he felt closer to God than ever before. As for me, he says in verse 28, it is good to be near God. I have made the sovereign Lord my refuge. And in the verses intervening between those two ends of the psalm, he tells us the story of this remarkable spiritual pilgrimage, of how he progressed from doubt back to a full confidence in God again. Let's trace it together then, this pilgrimage this man followed. We'll study it in two halves. We'll look first at the way he states his problem, which is in verses 1 through to verse 14. And then we'll look at the sort of solution that he found in verses 15 to 28. Start then by identifying the particular problem that gave rise to this man's doubts. And just as we've already anticipated, it arose out of the contradiction, he observed, between faith and reason, between theological theory, if you like, and observed fact. Now, the theological theory is in verse 1. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. That was his creed. I suspect he said that every Sabbath in church. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. It was the creed of any faithful Jew of his day. It's a nice comforting thought. God can be relied upon to be good to good people. That's what the creed says. Any Israelite who faithfully obeys the Ten Commandments can expect the Lord to honour that ancient covenant he made with Moses and bless him unreservedly for his obedience. But you see, as the psalmist looked around the world, he observed that things didn't square up with that creedal proposition of his. If anything, the evidence was rather weighted to the contrary. He tells us in verses 3 and 4 and so on, when I looked around, I saw the prosperity, not of the pure in heart, but of the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They're free from the burdens common to man. They're not plagued by human ills, and so on and so forth. There's a note of cynicism and bitterness flowing through verses 3 to 11. I expect you noticed it as we read it just now. It's as if the psalmist is saying, come on, let's face it. Whatever we say in church, it's the corrupt, it's the callous people of this world who've got no problems. They get away with murder. Physically, they seem to be a picture of health. Emotionally, they don't have any of the anxiety or depression that burden us. Proud and contemptuous as they are, he says, they shoot their mouth off, they boss people about, but nothing ever seems to happen to humiliate them. Ruthless and cruel, he says, they intimidate and oppress other people. But nobody ever seems to call them to account for their crimes. On the contrary, he says, as often as not, they get rewarded for their crimes with popularity. Verse 10, the people turn to them and drink in their words like water. They admire them, they flatter them, they suck up to them. Nothing succeeds like success. These people talk like atheists, he says. How can God know, they say. God's an irrelevancy to us. He doesn't know anything about us. He's not going to do anything to punish us, they say. All that hellfire and damnation stuff they talk about in church, that's just old wives' tales. Nothing bad's ever going to happen to us. And says the psalmist, nothing ever does. This is what the wicked are like, verse 12. Always carefree. They increase in wealth. This is the problem, then, that confronts this man, that leads to his doubts. Unlike some of us, it's not what we call acts of God, like famines and tornadoes and so on, that challenged his faith. It was rather acts of men. Injustice and exploitation and violence. How can God let them get away with it? That's his question. The Bible says, God is good to the pure in heart. But again and again I look around the world, says the poet, and I see the prosperity of the wicked. Well, it's a problem we can all sympathise with, isn't it? In our papers recently we've seen some of these appalling cases of child abuse and murder that are on police files. And so many of them, unsolved. These people have got away with it. We hear of violent bank robbers who are living in luxury in South America on the proceeds of their crime, writing articles in Sunday newspapers sometimes, proud of the fact. They've got away with it. We hear of vicious dictators who have survived to die peacefully in their beds in spite of all the cruelty and oppression that they have inflicted on other people. They've got away with it. It's like my mother used to tell me when I came home, having been punched in the playground. It's an unjust world, Roy. Virtue is triumphant only in theatricals, she used to say. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. Pull the other leg, Moses. You'll have to make the world honest before you can honestly say honest is the best policy. You might be asking in your mind, well, all right, it's a problem, but what's new about it? I mean, surely the psalmist didn't suddenly wake up one day and notice that all this thing was true, you know, that the wicked were doing all right, thank you very much. Surely that fact had been obvious to him for years. Why did it suddenly turn into a crisis of faith for this man? Well, I think you'll find the answer to that in verses 13 and 14. Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure, he says. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been plagued. I've been punished every morning. Shouldn't be so, I know. But if we're honest, we have to admit that for most of us, the problem of innocent suffering remains a purely academic problem until we become the suffering innocent in question. Then we get bothered about it. Suddenly the problem of innocent suffering assumes massive proportions in our minds. It's just human nature, I'm afraid. French have a proverb, we are strong enough to bear the ills of others, it says. Yes, we are. It's our own ills we get angry about, don't we? You know, when the election comes over next month, though 95% of the electorate will be persuading themselves that they are really trying to vote for what's best for the country, the truth is, they will be voting for what they perceive as best for themselves. It's human nature. The essayist Hazlitt writes, the smallest pain in my little finger generates more mental concern in me than the destruction of thousands of my fellow men. Isn't that so? Still, at least the psalmist doesn't mask the fundamentally self-centered nature of his anger about the prosperity of the wicked. It would have been very easy for him, you know, to have rationalised his scepticism with high-sounding cant about social injustice and the exploitation of the poor and so on. He could have ranted and raved about the evils of the capitalist system or about the failure of the government to maintain proper law and order and things like that. And I think it's to his credit that he's honest enough to look inside his heart and confess that his moral indignation was born more of enlightened self-interest than genuine moral idealism. I envied the arrogant, he says in verse 3. That's the truth of the matter. I envied them. If I'd shared their prosperity, I'd have been a great deal less bothered about the toleration God was showing towards these wicked people. It's only when I found myself victimized by God's providence, when I found myself plagued all day long, punished every morning, that these hostile questions began to rise within me. And that's true of most of us, isn't it? We read daily in our newspapers of children killed on the roads. But it never really threatens our faith, does it? Till it's our child that's involved in the accident. We hear of hundreds of people in hospital dying from cancer or heart attacks, but we never feel it to be a massive spiritual problem. That it's my wife or my husband that's in the mortuary. There are thousands of people walking the streets unemployed today in our country. We pass them every day, some of them. But it's not till I lose my job, is it, that I suddenly start waving my fist at heaven and complaining about all the injustice in the world. It's the way we are. The question we always want to ask is, why me? There are lots of people in the world more wicked than I am, God. Why do I have to be the one to suffer? Why do I have to be the one who's poor, the one who's sick, the one who's lost my loved one? Why did it happen to me? Those first-person singulars give us away. It is not our social conscience that is really outraged. It is our envy that has been inflamed. I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, says the psalm. Still, the problem he poses is a real one, isn't it? Even if our motives are mixed in raising it, what answer are we to give to it? How are we to defend God against the charge of moral indifference? What remedy are we to apply to a faith that is fast slipping into despair under the assault of these kinds of doubts? Maybe there's somebody here this morning who sympathizes very, very much with the psalmist, who feels themselves under attack from doubt right now for similar reasons, because things have gone wrong in their lives and they don't feel they deserve it. And the devil is feeding into their minds thoughts like, you can't really believe in God if he does that to you. Perhaps there's a tone of irony when you sang earlier that hymn, How Great Thou Art. Oh yes, it's all very well for all them to sing that, How Great Thou Art. But as for me, my feet have almost slipped. In vain have I kept my heart pure, for all day long I've been plagued. I've been punished every morning. Maybe there's someone who knows just what that feels like. Well, if so, you see, this psalm ought to be a great encouragement to you. Ought to be a reassurance to you. You're not an unbeliever because you feel like that. You're not an unbeliever because you want to talk to God like that. Indeed, this psalm is in the Bible to encourage you to talk like that. It's okay to express such thoughts. Inspired men of God in the Bible express just the same thoughts. Why shouldn't you? You're not an unbeliever because you have doubt. There is an answer to your doubt. The psalmist found it. You can too. So let's move to that second half of the poem, the solution that he discovered. And notice where it was he discovered it. Verse 15 to 17. If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed this generation of your children. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me. Till I entered the sanctuary of God. John Wesley recounts in his journals how one day he was walking with a friend, and his friend was very troubled about his personal trials, and he was expressing doubt about God's goodness. I don't know, he says, what I'm going to do with all my doubts. Wesley pointed to a cow who was looking over a stone wall adjoining the road where they were walking. Why do you think that cow's looking over the wall? He said. Well, I suppose because he can't see through it, said his friend rather naively. Precisely, said Wesley. When you can't see through your doubts, you must try looking over them. And he went on to explain what he means. It may sound a little glib. I suppose the advice, look to the Lord, is sometimes used by Christians as a rather trite platitude to avoid really getting involved with other people's problems, isn't it? But rightly understood and rightly applied, it enshrines a therapy which is the answer to doubt and which the psalmist here discovered. Till I entered the sanctuary of God, he said, it was oppressive to me. We human beings, we're like the moon. We live on borrowed light. And when our faces are turned away from God, we're always left with nothing but the darkness of our own shadows. The first step out of doubt is always to turn our eyes from the problem or over the problem to try and catch a glimpse of God himself. That's what happened to the psalmist. He was so battered by the perplexity of his mental and emotional struggle that he tells us he was within an ace of abandoning the people of God altogether. Thoughts, he says, were going through his head which, if he'd actually vocalized them, if he'd actually spoken them out publicly, would have constituted blasphemy and apostasy. If I'd said what was in my mind, he says, I would have betrayed this generation of your people. But somehow, in the midst of this spiritual turmoil he was going through, he found his way to the temple. Or maybe he couldn't avoid going. Perhaps he was in the choir or something. Maybe he had to preach, even. And it was there in church that at last his mind began to clear. Till I entered the sanctuary of God, he says. What did he discover there? In the sanctuary, in the experience of worship, that so transformed his whole attitude to his doubts. Well, he discovered three things, we find, as we look through the remainder of these verses. First, he discovered a new perspective on human destiny. Look at the end of verse 17. Then I understood their final destiny, he says. Surely you place them on slippery ground, you cast them down to ruin. One of the things worship does, well, I suppose the primary thing worship does, is to put God at the centre of our vision. Worship is an exercise in theocentric thinking. It gives us a God-centred perspective, and that's important, because it's only when God is at the centre of our perspective we see things as they really are. So long as we put ourselves at the centre, our vision of things is hopelessly distorted. We get things all out of proportion. We don't see things in their true perspective. One of the reasons worship is so important in our lives is that it delivers us from that distorting self-absorption. It enables us to see things in God's light. When we cannot see through our doubts, worship enables us to see over them, to get a new perspective on them. See, the psalmist was bothered because wicked people seemed to be doing rather well. It wasn't until he started to worship that he suddenly realized he wasn't seeing things from the perspective of God at all. He was seeing things from the short-sighted perspective of a time-bound observer. Once he got these wicked men in heaven's perspective, their destiny looked altogether different. Then I understood their final destiny, he said. Surely you place them on slippery ground. The trouble with us human beings is, you see, we tend to ignore what we can't see. The future is unknown to us, so we live as if it didn't exist. Live for today, we say. But God's response to that kind of preoccupation with the present moment is always to say, you're a fool. Your soul is going to be required of you one day. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Oh, I know people mock about judgment, about the end of the world, about heaven and hell. But you see, the fact is, as far as the Bible is concerned, these things are dreadfully real. If they weren't real, then the psalmist would be right. There would be no hope for goodness in this world at all. If they weren't real, there'd be no real reason for pursuing goodness in this world at all. Because in the final analysis, goodness wouldn't count for anything at all. It's because God, who made this world, has placed his moral verdict on human history, at the end of human history, and said there will be a judgment. People will not get away with it forever. That we dare to believe goodness matters. But we will only get that perspective, you see, when we come before God and see things as he sees them. While we're preoccupied with the present moment, that will get blurred out of our mind. The man of faith is a man who's, because he's caught God's perspective on history, takes the future seriously. Like Moses, he's content, if necessary, to share the ill treatment he gets with the people of God, rather than to continue enjoying the temporary pleasures of being a member of Pharaoh's court, because he's looking to the long term. He knows what counts in the final analysis. People who haven't got that perception of the future inevitably, will see no real value in goodness. You've got to believe it counts long term to be committed to goodness. Because in the short term, there are many sufferings for good people. That's the reality of the world. Now, the man of faith, you see, is a man who realizes that just because the future can't be seen doesn't mean it's imaginary. God sees it even if we don't. His reality includes tomorrow as well as today. And from his perspective, the prosperity of the wicked, says the psalmist, is as illusory as a dream. Look at verse 20. As a dream when one awakes, so when you arise, O Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. You ever had one of those nightmares that you wake up from suddenly and you're sweating with anxiety? You switch the bedroom light on and suddenly you laugh at your foolishness. It all seems so real, you say. But it wasn't. Once you wake up, you despise it as an illusion and you think no more about it. What a fool I was, you say, to get so excited about a dream. Well, that's how God sees the prosperity of the wicked, you see. It's not real because it's not eternal. One day we shall awake and realize that that kind of prosperity is as insubstantial as a figment of the imagination, a mere passing dream. Indeed, perhaps there is no more terrible judgment upon such wickedness of men than that at the last day they will find themselves finally and unspeakably ignored. Depart from me, I never knew you, Jesus will say. You're not real, you're not part of my eternity. It's a terrifying thing to be despised by God like an unpleasant nightmare, but that's what the Bible is saying here. God will treat such wickedness as, O Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. Once he went into the temple, you see, once he came into a place of worship and put God at the center of the stage, the psalmist was able to see just how precarious this prosperity of godless men was that he was envying so much. The second thing his new perspective did for him as he came into God's house to worship is this. It gave him a new perspective on himself. Verse 21. When my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you, he says. Yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward you will take me into glory. Now you see, part of the trouble is, once we get into a mood of morbid introspection, it very quickly becomes a vicious circle. We do not feel like worshipping God. We would rather wallow in our self-pity and nourish our resentment against him. So we lock ourselves away securely in the prison of our own self-absorption, and the darkness grows deeper and deeper. That's what often happens in our doubting times. Perhaps that's one reason why a habit of coming to church on Sunday is a good thing. Because if we didn't discipline ourselves to worship God regularly, to regularly force ourselves to put him at the center of our lives, then when those doubts and problems came, we would not have the help of this new perspective, this heavenly perspective which worship can give to us, because we wouldn't feel like worshiping. A good habit will often overrule a weak will and save us from untold misery in this regard. Because you see, once we are in the place of worship, willingly or not, we're exposed to the presence of God, and immediately we open our hearts up to God's presence. Isn't it true? We see ourselves as we really are. Things about ourselves, perhaps, that we would rather not see. We see, for instance, the sulkiness of our behavior. We see the childishness of our resentment. We see how pathetic our self-pity is. I envied the arrogant. Yes, we're even honest enough to admit that's really what it came down to. And we kick ourselves with embarrassment for entertaining such foolish attitudes. I was a brute beast before you, senseless and ignorant. When my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, this is the way it often will be. But you see what happened when he came into worship? He could pull all that bitterness and that senselessness and that brutishness behind him. He suddenly discovered something else about himself. He suddenly discovered that in spite of all his doubts and foolish talk, he nevertheless was a child of God. Yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will take me into glory. As long as we stay out of the temple, you see, as long as we stay away from church, we can hide the truth about ourselves. The devil can tell us, you're not a real Christian. How can you be a Christian? Thinking the way you do about God, angry as you are with God, having all these doubts you do, how can you be a Christian? How can you be a believer? Don't laugh, make me laugh. It isn't, you see, till we come into the experience of worship again, if we put God at the centre of the stage, that we realise it's not only our doubts we have to come to terms with. It's our faith we have to come to terms with too. Our faith, our experience of God, is just as much a real part of our lives as these doubts that trouble us. Our circumstances arise that we find extremely difficult to reconcile intellectually with the reality of God that we have felt. But no amount of circumstances can annihilate that experience. One of the reasons we come into God's house every week is to rediscover through worship this fundamental truth about ourselves. That he is always with us. That he holds us by his right hand. That he guides us with his counsel. That he will take us to glory. To surrender to our doubts would be just as false to our true selves as if we pretended those doubts didn't exist, you see. Such an important thing to grasp hold of this. Faith is not a delicate little plant that you have to keep in a greenhouse for fear that it's going to get knocked down by the wind and the rain. Faith is a hardy perennial. It can stand the weather because it isn't something you've concocted out of your own feelings. Faith isn't a carefully proven thesis of human logic which you've decided you agree with. Faith is an intuitive grasp of spiritual reality. It's a supernatural assurance that springs up even when everything around it seems guaranteed to extinguish it, even when we perhaps ourselves try to extinguish it. If you don't believe that's true, you just try the sort of experiment the psalmist here was toying with. You say to yourself, right, I'm fed up with this Christianity lark. I've got far too many intellectual problems to be a Christian any longer. I'm going to give it up. I've got too many doubts. I throw in the towel. And try it. Just imagine yourself in that situation. And you tell me if it isn't true, what I say, that no sooner have you conducted the experiment than you realize it's impossible. You can't give up faith like that. It isn't like that. It doesn't adhere in the personality like that. As hard as we try to deny it, true faith keeps reasserting itself like a cork pushed down under the surface of water. You only have to lift your finger a minute and up it's bobbed again. Because God is real to us. You can't run away from his presence any more than the psalmist can. I am always with you. See, faith is not something we cook up in ourselves. It's not sustained by our willpower. It's something God has put into our souls. We can no more run away from it than we can run away from our own heartbeat. He discovered that about himself, you see, in the temple. While he stayed out of contact with God, he could kid himself that he wasn't a believer, that he could live as if he wasn't a believer, and it wouldn't make any difference. As soon as he was brought face to face with God in worship, the illusion about himself dissolved. What a fool I am, he said. It was just the bitterness of my heart that was making me think I could possibly be like that. Now I'm always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. You will take me into glory. And the third thing, which his experience of worship did for him, the final thing, which dissolved his doubts and brought him back to a position of faith and assurance again, is this. It gave him a new perspective on what are real values. Look at verse 25. Whom have I in heaven but you? And being with you, I desire nothing on earth. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. There was a famous professor, you know, on the BBC radio years ago. Some of you oldies will remember him, Professor Joad. And he was famous because whenever he was asked a question as a panelist, he always started his answer with the words, "Well, it all depends on what you mean by." It's a very good ploy, actually, for answering examination questions. You can... I guess if we were asked to comment on the question, is God good to the pure in heart? We might be justified in replying, well, it all depends on what you mean by good. If you mean, does God make all pure in heart people rich? It's palpably not true. If you mean, does God make all pure in heart people healthy? That's palpably not true as well. If you mean, does God make all pure in heart people popular? That isn't true. So if bestowing riches and health and popularity is what you mean by doing people good, God is not good to the pure in heart. But then you see, those kinds of benefits, though they may be real blessings in their way, they are not what real goodness consists in, are they? Indeed, it is perhaps the tragedy of many people in this world that they allow the pursuit of such good things to rob them of the best things. Whom have I in heaven but you? And being with you, I desire nothing on earth. Some of us here, in the enthusiastic flush of young romance, held somebody's hand and said, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, for better, for worse. If we meant them, what we meant by what we were saying in those promises is that at that moment in time, at any rate, and hopefully still today, having that person in our lives was more precious to us than any other good thing we can think of. For better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness or in health. The very enjoyment of that prosperity we had in life depended upon our ability to share it with them. Being with them, we really desired nothing else. Well, if human love can be such a precious treasure, if human love can make us so indifferent to materialistic physical welfare, then where on earth should the love of God figure in our scale of values? My flesh and my heart may fail, writes the psalmist. But God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. You know, one of these days, you may have paid off your mortgage. But the house will still fall down one of these days. One of these days, you may get that car you've been longing for, which is so much better than your neighbour's car. But it will still rust. Do you really believe that those are the things that make life good? Because if you do, I pity you. Here is the pearl of great price for which a man sells all he has. This psalmist has discovered the beauty of that pearl of great price when he came into God's house to worship, and in the light of that beauty, his envy at the prosperity of others dissolved away. He got things back in perspective. Yes, God is good to Israel, he says. But I'm going to define what I mean by good. As for me, it is good to be near God. That's what I mean by good, he says. As for me, it is good to be near God. Being with him, I desire nothing else on earth. Here it is then. A man with doubts, who struggled his way through to become a man with a testimony. Let me say a word, first of all, this morning to those of you here who are Christians. And the word I want to say to you is this: do not run away from your doubts. Oh, maybe you're the academic type, maybe you're a student, and your doubts, generally speaking, arise from your intellectual discipline. You have problems with the Bible, or problems over miracles, or something of that sort. Or maybe you're an unsophisticated person, you don't have any pretensions at being clever or academic, and your doubts, like the psalmist's, tend to arise more from the practical circumstances of life than the books you read. Whatever the source of your doubts is, I say the same: don't run away from them. See, all the Christian who closes his mind to any subject or any issue that threatens his faith is actually confessing is his unbelief. Because if he really believed his religion was true, he could launch into any sphere of human inquiry, any experience of human life, in the confidence that that truth would vindicate itself. How could it not? See, we mustn't allow ourselves to yield to that schoolboy definition of faith. Faith, he said, is believing what you know ain't true. It's nonsense. Compelling myself to believe is no part of true religion. A Christian believes under the constraint of the truth. Jesus said, I am the truth, you see. We don't give up the quest for truth and receive Jesus instead. It's as the truth Jesus wants to be received. He's more concerned than anybody else about your integrity, a profession of faith achieved only by jettisoning your personal honesty. Doesn't please him. So I say again, don't run away from your doubts. There's nothing unspiritual about doubts. Learn that from the psalmist. Great saints of God have struggled with doubt. What's unspiritual is to refuse to acknowledge that doubt, to hide from it, to pretend it's not there. And I tell you, all that policy will do in the long run, it will not protect your faith. In the long run, it will weaken your faith, just like a muscle that wastes away for lack of use because its owner is forever fearful of straining it. So your faith will wither if you are not courageously honest about your real thoughts. Look your doubt in the face. Or maybe you will have to struggle as the psalmist did. Maybe you will have to shed tears as he did. But in the long run, the reality of God in your life will be stronger because you've wrestled with those doubts, not weaker. But I want to say something, too, to those of you here who are not Christians. Now, I'm not denying you have got problems about believing in Christianity. Of course you have, and not for one moment am I suggesting that you should sweep those problems you've got under your mental carpet and pretend you haven't got them. But I want to suggest to you that your doubts aren't the only things you've got. I suggest to you that every now and again, just like the psalmist, perhaps when, like him, you come into church or when you read the Bible, or are left alone with your thoughts for just a moment. Every now and again, there's a nagging intuition inside you that God is real. You feel him tugging at your heart, even while your mind rebels with a dozen arguments that prove he can't exist. Isn't that true? Now, what I want to say to you is, you must do justice to those intuitions you have. If you want to tell the Christian that he mustn't run away from his doubts, you must allow him to tell you that you mustn't run away from your faith. In fact, you can't run away from it. It will pursue you. Perhaps you tell me, oh, well, I need proof. Well, what do you mean by that? Scientific proof? You can't be serious. You know better than to ask for that. You know perfectly well God can't be put in a test tube and proven. Anyway, there are 1,001 things that you believe in that you can't prove scientifically. I mean, can you measure the difference between right and wrong with your slide rule? Can you distinguish love from lust with a voltmeter? Now, don't be so superficial. Why, even if I could prove to you, scientifically, that God exists, even if I could prove to you that behind the steely brightness of the stars there's a great cosmic intelligence that keeps the whole show going, it wouldn't do you any good, would it? That wouldn't be what you're looking for. It's not the objective scientific proof of God's existence we want. It is the experience of God's presence in our lives. That's what we hunger for, isn't it? That's the miracle we want. And that is the miracle we get. I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. You will receive me into glory. Whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian this morning, the answer to doubt is not to be less honest with yourself, but to be more honest with yourself. Honest with yourself about the questions you've got, but honest with yourself also about that irrepressible, irresistible seed of faith that keeps on tugging at your mind and heart and demanding that you recognize it. Unto your own self be true, says the bard, and it must follow as surely as the night, the day, you cannot then be false to any man. I ask you then, isn't it time you stopped complaining about doubts and started surrendering to your faith? Isn't it time you passed from the agony of all those questions you cannot answer to the challenge of that truth that deep in your heart you know you cannot deny? Let's pray together. Let's take a moment of silence. And in that moment, let's take the opportunity to try to be honest with ourselves in God's presence. Honest with ourselves about what we feel, about our doubts, but also about our perception of Him, dim though perhaps it may be.